Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Joined today by Josh Blank, research director of the Texas Politics Project. Welcome back, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So we're maybe a little punchy. A lot going on here at the Texas Politics Project this week.
It's getting busy. The election is getting closer and closer. I'll say this. We do a lot of press calls. You expect to pick up. It's picking up a little bit earlier, I think, than it has in the past.
Yeah,
maybe,
yeah. So, lot happening. So all that aside today we thought we'd talk around the subject of a piece that we've been working on for the last couple of weeks that, will be out at the website at texaspolitics.utexas.edu by the time this podcast is posted, we think, that connects public opinion data from the August UT Texas Politics Project poll that focused on elections and voting. And stories that have been in the news over the last few weeks about recent rhetoric and actions by Texas officials in the realm of voting and elections in the run-up to the big election in November. Now, that piece argues, a few different things. It's a first kind of a long, kind of deeper piece we've done in a couple of months, I guess, I think. And the piece kind of argues that, patterns in public opinion suggest that over the last two decades of a kind of call and response between Republican voters and Republican elected officials on the themes of voter fraud and election integrity, something of a term of art, have had some troubling effects in the Texas political system. And we kind of unpack some of the connections that have been feeding this dynamic, and the piece goes in a couple of different directions. One of the important themes of the piece is that this, what we're calling this kind of call and response here, and we'll unpack that a little in the podcast, has made distrust of elections and a voting process a pretty standard, almost fix is a little too strong a word.
Yeah, but baseline maybe is.
But a kind of, a baseline ever-present attitude among a majority of Republican voters in the state.
Right.
And this dynamic has eroded some of the key norms around elections and voting that provided the boundaries for legitimate policy and rhetoric by policy leaders historically in Texas, and I would argue to some degree in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So today we'll cover some of this ground. We're going to try to do that as quickly as possible and let the piece do some of the work for us, and discuss some related takeaways from looking at this, not just the latest data, but at the sequence of events and the longer history of voting politics in the state and the patterns in public opinion that have developed as these politics have unfolded. So we'll start the discussion with some, current events, and when you're teaching, current events are always a good hook. So, Josh, just give us the bullet list of some of these stories.
Yeah, it was hard as people who follow this stuff regularly not to notice in the last couple of weeks the convergence really across multiple political actors around this issue of, concerns around the upcoming election. So it started a little while back, and again, in the most recent instance with Attorney General Ken Paxton's office investigation into allegations of non-citizen voter registration, which led to the raiding of homes of some Latino voting activists and a Texas House candidate whose opponent, Ken Paxton, has actually endorsed. This has resulted in calls for civil rights investigations by a lot of civil rights groups, both inside Texas and beyond. Following that was Governor Abbott's trumpeting of routine state efforts to clear the voter rolls of deceased, relocated, usually to different states, and very, very rarely potentially, ineligible voters who've somehow made their way onto the voter rolls. Abbott used the word purge in this case. His choice, not mine here in terms of describing these efforts. But it's
kind of off noticed.
But it's yes. It's a noticeable choice of words. Paxson's office continued with legal suits against Bexar County to stop the county from sending voter registration forms to unregistered residents in the lead up to the election. The office made similar efforts to stop Travis County from hiring a third party to contact non-registered county residents and registered in the vote. This has resulted in a countersuit from Travis County that they've moved this into federal courts. And then just yesterday, the Secretary of State, Jay Nelson, former state senator, sent a letter to the director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, quote, requesting your assistance in verifying or ascertaining the citizenship or immigration status of certain individuals on the state of Texas's voter rolls. And so this is, you know, to say this is a multi-pronged effort going on right now, really, that's been kind of hard to, hard to avoid in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
did I miss anything?
Because we're trying to keep this, you know, relatively succinct. You know, there's also a lot of, you know, local level stuff.
Right.
I mean, you know, the fights in Tarrant County, right, and the debate going on in Tarrant County now over the location of the placement of voting locations at community colleges in the area, mm-hmm. et cetera. And I think, you know, to tie it all together, I mean, we want to point out there was some, you know, good reporting in the Dallas Morning News from Nolan McCaskill that, you know, the letter that Secretary of State Nelson sent to this federal agency had its origins ultimately in communication from Attorney General Paxton to the Secretary of State urging her to take this action and even helpfully providing a draft of the letter for the office. And if you look at Nolan McCaskill's reporting in the Morning News, there are links to these letters. You can look at the letters, compare the language, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Now,
it could have been AI.
You know, as you say, all of these developments, including the local stuff taken together, you know, strongly suggest a pattern in which Texas Republican elected officials are, you know, going to some lengths to publicly promote their determination to act in the service of ensuring the integrity of elections in the state. You can put that in quotation marks if you want. But there's also a literal, you know, there's a literal sense to that, I think, that helps them, that helps ground these efforts. But the issue that we kind of get out in the piece that we want to unpack a little today is the public opinion piece, of course. And that is that, you know, if you go back in the 20-plus years that this has been going on in Texas, and we talk about the roots of this in the piece, you know, at the same time that these kind of literal actions are taking place and these state actions are taking place, you know, the actions themselves and the promotion of them mm-hmm. are fueling citizens' fears, you know, about, you know, by providing these claims about voting by non-citizens or flaws in the process, right. You know, and, you know, or, you know, in the case of the Secretary of State's letter, to be fair to Jane Nelson, you know, there are no outright accusations, at least in her draft of the letter, but it fans suspicions about this threat. Just the very presence of these discussions means that this notion that there, you know, that there are either actual problems or hovering problems, you know, that come from ineligible voters being allowed to vote, it just keeps them very present in the mind of voters. And I think it's very plausible to argue that this has an impact on Republican voters' attitudes. I mean, we talk about Zoller and, you know,
right.
This kind of communication, you know, this notion that partisan elite communication has an impact on the attitudes of partisans,
right?
You know, and that there's something of a feedback loop here, and so, you know, and just, you know, a little example. I mean, in addition to the excellent reporting by the Dallas Morning News, mm-hmm. you know, the other reason we know about this is that the letter that the Secretary of State sent to the federal agency was posted on social media on X from the official Secretary of State account. If you want to look that up, it's at @TexSecOfState,
right.
At Tex Secretary of State. So, I mean, the idea, you know, I mean, I think you have, you know, one has to recognize that however much one Republican elected officials and their allies have relied on rhetoric that is on the face of it, perhaps a, you know, example of motivated reasoning, but also, you know, passes an initial very light sniff test, is that, look, you know, we are doing our jobs, right. And this is very much the spirit of the Secretary of State's letter.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing our jobs. It's our job to protect, you know, and everybody knows that we should, you know, we want our elections and our voting systems to be clean and beyond reproach. And so we have to make sure that we go the extra yard here, even while fanning this certain set of suspicion. So, you know, that is out there. So let's, you know, we want to unpack that. We'll come back to these linkages maybe and flesh them out. But let's look at the public opinion context briefly. Now, Josh, you know, you noticed early on as we were looking at the results of the August UT Texas Politics Project poll that we released about a week and a half ago, that there had been an interesting uptick in one of the election-related items in our poll that we've asked on repeated, you know, in repeated polling, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that we've been interested in over the course of this election, and really it's, you know, over the course of a number of years now, because of these sort of repeated efforts to call into question the validity of the electoral process, you know, both in Texas and nationally, is to look at attitudes towards the system, towards the functioning of democracy, towards potential threats to the electoral process, and overall trust in the system. So this is something that we repeatedly look at, because one of the questions becomes over time, is this something that continues to erode, or is it something that, you know, maybe is a little bit more fanned in the elections and then bounces back or whatever. So this is one of the sort of the longer term motivating impulses here and sort of understanding.
And within that, we've also, you know, I mean, because we do so much, you know, we're in the midst of election season right now, mm-hmm. but as everybody or most people that would be hearing this will know, you know, as it gets close to the legislative session in Texas that happens every other year, you know, we turn our attention towards
policymaking
and the bodies of laws that one expect that where there's a lot of action.
Right. I mean, we're fortunate in that we get to sort of take what we learn throughout the course of the campaign and the issues that get activated among voters, and we get to see the way that that gets transformed into a legislative agenda or not, or how much of it does, and how much of public opinion actually bears on those questions. And this is sort of, in some ways, start of making that transition. It's also the case that in, you know, polling about the elections, we want to poll on the issues that are most top of mind for voters, which is why we've asked a lot of questions about the economy. We've asked a ton of questions about immigration, about abortion. But what increasingly is, you know, a fact here is that the system itself is actually part of the campaigning that's going on. And that's true on both sides. And so it's a valid place just to look
at. And again, it's not about, you know, there's nothing nefarious about that.
No.
Right? That's kind of, you know.
No, I know.
That's kind of how it's supposed to work.
No, I mean.
I'm not saying you're implying.
I'm thinking about maybe you could, someone could take that as, you know, justifying why you're looking at these attitudes. Well, we're looking at these attitudes because to the extent that at least one side is saying you can't trust the election results and the other side is saying you can't trust these people as a threat to democracy, it seems worthwhile to ask questions about elections and the democracy.
I mean, I think to that, you know, the broader point to close out as you can go on is, but like, you know, I mean, I think I'm always mindful that, you know, what one person might see as responsiveness, another might see as pandering.
Yeah, I think that's fair, you know. And, you know, luckily we've been doing this long enough. I kind of hear then I throw my hands up and go, yeah, okay. We're both shrugging
right.
our shoulders. Okay. So what did we find? So we asked a question about, you know, again, we're looking specifically in some ways at state policy here. And what we found was, you know, we asked a question we've asked repeatedly about the state's voting laws and whether they should be made more strict, less strict, or left as they are now. And interestingly, in this poll, we found 65% of Republicans, so just about two-thirds, saying that the state's voting laws, which have repeatedly and have been repeatedly and significantly tightened over the last two decades of Republican rule, including very recently in the last number of years after the 2020 election, but 65% of Republican voters saying this law should be more strict. This was an 11-point increase over the share who said the same back in February of 2023, so a little bit over a year ago. That's the last time we asked a question. So it was already a majority of Republicans saying, yes, we should, you know, even this was after SB1, this was another session later, this is saying, hey, no, majority still want the laws made stricter. And as we get closer to this election, that's upticked even further. Now, this is pretty, you know, I think first and foremost, this sort of stuck out to me, you know, kind of like a sore thumb. Now, in some ways, you look at these results, and I think when you see a jump like that, there is a tendency, at least from my perspective, to say, is this a one-time blip? What, you know?
Yeah.
But the issue here in a lot of ways is that it's so internally consistent within the other attitudes in the poll, right? So when we look and we say, given this idea, that we find is that this widespread support for still stricter voting laws aligns with voters' lack of confidence that Americans are actually going to trust the results of the outcome of the election. So only 7% of Republicans were very confident that Americans are going to trust the results of the upcoming presidential election. So fewer than 1 in 10. And this is significantly less than even the 18% who were very confident at the end of the last presidential campaign in October 2020, when, again, there were many, many public communications about how why the election process shouldn't be trusted. So what we see here is actually a further decline in Republican trust, just generally in the idea that Americans themselves buy into these election results.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a, you know, that's a real linchpin of this discussion, I think, in a lot of ways. I mean, that is not just a little movement, you know, both in terms of thinking about thinking about state level laws and thinking about, you know, what the overall arc of that level of trust in elections is. Now, clearly there's an element of views about national politics here, and, you know, we can't talk about Republican views of elections without taking into account, you know, the influence of Donald Trump on this discussion nationally as, you know, if you will, the lead signaler of Republican politics and Republican attitudes. I mean, you know, we've got, you know, we'd have to go back into the specific numbers. You know, we've asked people periodically, you know, we asked in during the primary season, for example, you know, whose endorsement, you know, matters mm-hmm. most in Republican legislative primary elections.
Right.
And the primary response far and above anybody else was Donald Trump. So you can't, I don't think you can discount the impact of Trump on Republican attitudes.
Right, and that's right. I think the thing is, but at the same time, you could also overestimate it, right?
Yeah, well, right. And that's kind of the, you know, I mean, I think, you know, the thing is you can, and that's really one of the burrs under our saddle all the time. I mean, you know, we've discussed it many times in this podcast in a lot of different policy areas, you know, and we've made the point that many Republican beliefs, attitudes, and policies that we, you know, can be pretty sure are amplified, you know, and given pride of place, you know, rendered more prominent by Donald Trump, still have precedents in Texas that predate his rise. We've talked about this a lot in the context of immigration, and, you know, I think it applies here.
Yeah, I think that's right. So, like, look, I mean, just to put the number on it, you know, to the extent that Donald Trump has sowed doubts about the results of the last election, those took root among Republican voters and have remained. So in August of this year, and we've asked this question many times, 58% of Republican voters said that Joe Biden did not win the most recent presidential election legitimately, right? So nearly two-thirds. This has been pretty consistent. It's not as high as it was right after the election, but it's remained pretty consistent throughout, you know, the last couple years we've been polling it.
Yeah, right. I mean, if you really want to be an optimist about this, but I think, you know, you're really looking pretty hard. You can note that, I mean, you know, for the first year or so, year and a half after the election, the share of Republicans that said, you know, that they didn't think Joe Biden had legitimately won the election, you know, stayed pretty consistently at 60% or higher,
right,
and peaked at 69% a couple of times through 2023. So, you know, if you want to say, hey, look, the fever is breaking, it's only 59% now, you can.
Yeah.
But I think that's, you're trying very hard to be an optimist about that.
And again, I think, you know, one of the things you could do here is you could attribute that to Trump. But I think one of the things that we're trying to do in the piece here is point out that the roots to this, that the beliefs that make a claim like Trump's take root and hold already existed and had been cultivated for a very, very long time.
He was planting that seed in very fertile soil.
Right. And so there's a little bit of a slightly extended discussion about the role of voter ID, you know, in this. But the important, I think, you know, public opinion sort of, you know, observation to take away from this is essentially the big partisan differences in perceptions about essentially the frequency and seriousness of illegal voting, you know, ineligible voters voting, voter fraud, whatever you want to call it on the one hand, and how extensive that is among Republicans, and looking at that also in the context of the presence and availability of attitudes towards voter suppression among Democrats. Now, there's two different points here, and we'll sort of first let's just talk about Republicans for a second, because I think this is actually the most important point. So consistently, and we've asked these sort of pairs of questions multiple times in a couple of different ways, and we can talk about some of the details of this maybe a little bit later, but the takeaway point here is to say is despite really extensive efforts, and we can kind of go back and we sort of list some of these down the piece. We talk about the voter ID laws. We talk about the difficulty, I'll say difficulties, you know, increasing challenges that the state has put in place to register people to vote. The way that the state has, let's say, implemented changes to early voting laws. You know, really the entirety of SB 1 and sort of the fight around that, among many other things and further discussions, right. Obviously, you know, an important sort of thing that, you know, the criminalization of routine voting errors in some cases, whether, you know, in new laws or even just the public criminalizing and sort of, you know, promoting of what happens to people who usually accidentally vote illegally in the state. You know, this has been going on for, you know, again, two decades solidly. And yet these attitudes that Republican voters hold about both the frequency of illegal voting and the extent of its seriousness have not really changed appreciably over that time period. So,
and those attitudes are that it happens, you know.
Yeah, it happens a lot.
Pluralities and, or majorities think it happens, you know, frequently or very often. And
they think it's extreme,
and they
extremely
think it's really important.
And it's an extremely serious problem. And what's interesting about this, you know, we have a colleague here, you know, Chris, who talks about, you know, these you know, again, this sort of thermostatic policy response. And the idea is that
Chris Lasian.
Normally, I like to be casual. Normally, yeah, well, I'm just getting older, you know, I want to.
I'm the footnote.
Yeah. So normally the idea is the public, you know, in a sort of a normal process, you might think the public has concerns, right? Policymakers respond to those concerns with policies, and then the people say, oh, okay, my policy concerns have been addressed in whole, in part, whatever, and then it becomes less of a concern. This is not,
or not.
Yeah, and this is not the nature of this system here, whereby even with concerted and consistent attention to the voting system here in Texas, Republican voters have in no point decreased their belief that there's fraud in the system. And if anything, as we saw in the most recent rules, actually think the laws need to continue to be made more strict.
Right.
So that's the main kind of observation.
I'm trying to think about how to torture the metaphor of the thermostat and the HVAC. I'm not going to go into it. But something's broken.
Right.
You know, you call a repairman.
Yeah, and there's even more things that I kind of left out of, you know, the overall arc here. You can think about redistricting fights. You can think about the Supreme Court's limiting of the Voting Rights Act and the impact that's had. I mean, these are extended fights.
Even the public fights over redistricting in 2000 and 2010.
Right. And so
provide some overarching elite queuing here.
And what's really remarkable about this is that if anything, you know, none of these actions have actually done anything to assuage the fears of Republican voters. If anything, they've just merely hardened, right? So if we look at the share, for example, of Republicans who say that ineligible voters are voting frequently in Texas elections, and then again, they could say they're voting sometimes, not at all, right? But just frequently. In June of 2024, it was 1 in 4 Republican voters say this is happening frequently. In June of 2021, sort of, you know, again, during the SB1 debate, it was 31%. I mean, as far as we're concerned, that's not really an appreciable change when we're talking about the share. Say this is something that's going on regularly.
Now, you go from about 1 in 4 to a little less than 1 in 3. That's just not
right. Exactly. It's not really appreciable. So, you know, what this means is that if you look at this years of data, you can say that, you know, most GOP voters still see voter fraud as a major problem, despite these decades of effort to shore up the system and no substantial evidence that there's ever actually been any sort of widespread problem. So then the question becomes, why is this happening? Right. What is this sort of dynamic that's producing
this? What is it
this?
That keeps those attitudes in place? Despite this kind of, you know, what we would think of as this thermostatic dynamic.
Right.
Right. And I think, you know, so we want to, you know, discuss and talk about the answer. But I mean, I think, you know, if you go back to where we started a few minutes ago, you know, the degree to which, you know, these attitudes are being reinforced, you know, whether in the absence of evidence by action.
Yeah, well, you know,
is really interesting.
Well, what's interesting is that the policy. So, you know, from a practical standpoint, we've talked about this before, but because, you know, this is because there actually is no evidence of significant fraud in the state, and this we talked about this in the wake of the 2020 election, and sort of a lot of during that session, we talked about this a lot in terms of the voting bill, the SB1 that made its way through the process and sort of the weird twists and turns that it took to get there. And part of the reason that bill was actually kind of difficult to pass, even before the Democrats left, was in a lot of ways because of the fact that it's, I mean, I don't want to use cliches here, but, you know, it's a solution in search of a problem. Without an actual policy problem to address, it means that really you need to find these policy solutions. But the policy solutions themselves, in some ways, reinforce the message. You know, if we do need, again, stricter voter ID requirements, you're implying because people are voting illegally. If we do need to clear the rolls of, you know, potential non-citizen voters, and we'll come back to that regularly, or we do need, you know, the counties to provide the attorney general's office with, you know, near constant updates about, you know, potential discrepancies in their own, you know, voting list, you're implying that there's serious problems here, even though we're not actually seeing anybody right. point to real problems.
And look, I think to be fair, I want to present what is often the fallback argument on this, and it's kind of a two-part.
To be fair, is my line.
it's a two-point. It's, you know, there's two main points to make here. One of which, you know, I think is evident if we go look at Secretary of State Nelson's letter, which is, you know, it's our job to be preventative.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, and you know, the second piece of that is the grounding for that, which is, you know, we need to have something akin to a zero tolerance policy. That the integrity of the electoral system is so important that even if the incidents we have are sporadic, there's very little evidence that in, you know, 99% of the cases, and we should, you know, there's a couple of cases that we, you know, should flag, you know, in out the outer areas of Harris County a couple of cycles ago, et cetera. But even if those incidents are sporadic and at best, you know, very uncommon, that should still drive our efforts.
And
right. And so I think, you know, it's fair to have that out there, but it doesn't, but it, that does not, that's not really responsive to, you know, the way in which, you know, these efforts are couched and the intimations that accompany them and how they plug into other elements that are out there.
Well, and I think that observation is really important because it actually speaks to an asymmetry in terms of mobilizing on the one hand on the fraud issue and on the other hand on voter suppression, because Democrats have really not been terribly successful at mobilizing on this idea that the state is suppressing voters, to my read, you know. And I would say that read is both based on, you know, what I've observed in the campaigns and what the focus has been, but also even just, you know, in our own public opinion analyses, you know, when we ask people these questions about whether the Texas political system or the electoral system discriminates against racial and ethnic minorities, we don't see high levels of agreement with that. Even among Democrats, where you know, again, you see more agreement than you do among Republicans, where you see very little, it's still not an overwhelmingly widespread viewpoint because it's not as salient of an issue. And the question becomes, well, why is that? And I think you really laid out in some ways what the asymmetry is here, and it connects with the public opinion data that we go into more deeply in the piece, which is that for Republicans, not only do they see, you know, again, voter fraud as both a frequent problem and an extremely serious problem.
We say the Republicans, Republican voters.
Republican voters.
Yeah.
Right. So because of that, you know, say it's going to reinforce this view and why, right? Well, because ultimately, if I am a voter going on voting and somebody is voting illegally, it can plausibly be argued that my vote is being diluted. You can either say, and it depends, you know, you can mess with the extent of that. I can say, well, my vote's being canceled. I can say it's being diluted. You know,
right.
I can say the entire outcome is being called into question.
And if you believe, you know, the unsubstantiated rhetoric that, you know, undocumented immigrants are voting in massive numbers.
And for Democrats.
You're being swamped.
Right, exactly.
You're not just being diluted or can't, you know, you're being, you know, the imagery that, you know, Donald Trump deploys and that his allies in the state have period, you know, often choose to echo is, you know, there's this reserve army of voters being mobilized by now. That if they're not swamping you today, they will eventually.
And as that voter, you know, I don't mute, you know, the rage I might feel about that or whatever, it's not mutually exclusive to me. I can feel it. Someone else can. Everybody, you know, can feel that way about it if they want to. Now, for Democrats on the issue of suppression, it's a little bit difficult because when you're talking to Democratic voters, you're talking to people presumably who vote, which means they've engaged with the process. The process has worked for them. And so at least, you know, in an experiential sense, it feels as though, you know, the system is working. Similarly, and this is just sort of the way this works, you know, if somebody else's rights are suppressed and they don't get to vote, it doesn't actually suppress my rights as a voter. So the direct connection between myself and the idea of suppression is necessarily a little bit more abstracted. And when we look at Democratic attitudes, what we find is that, yeah, you know, they do think that, you know, voters are basically being, you know, suppressed to some extent. They either think it's happening frequently, but less frequently than Republicans think are voting, you know, or that there's legal. And they think it's less serious because ultimately it's just not as, again, directly attachable to someone who is already a voter operating effectively in the system to say, yeah, but other people can't or other people aren't.
Yeah. I mean, look, a third of Democratic voters, more or less, in many of the results we've gotten about the seriousness of people voting who are not eligible, also agree that, you know, that's
yeah, it's
a
serious.
Problem.
Nobody wants that.
I mean, it's, you know, it's dwarfed by the share of Republicans. But I mean, I think that's, you know, that's sort of some of the empirical grounding for, you know, the fallout from what you're saying.
One other issue I think, you know, I noticed, and we didn't put this in the piece because it's a little bit, again, there's so many things you could talk about this data. But I mean, one of the things you notice, or we noticed at least, you know, Democratic concerns about these issues were a little bit less than they were in previous years, a little in terms of the frequency, you know, the intensity of it. And part of that, I'd say, is, you know, what did we have in the last few years? Really high turnout elections. You know, yeah. We had a lot of Democrats turning out. We had, you know, again, the highest Democratic vote totals repeatedly, first in a midterm, then in a, you know, in a presidential, then in a midterm, then in another presidential. So when you ask Democrats, you know, are Democrats having trouble voting? For a lot of them, the feeling of it is going to be no.
Yeah.
Right. But the specter of fraud, which has never gone away, remains.
Right. And I think so, you know, and I think that's a great breakdown of the internal dynamics here that help fuel the ability of Republican opinion leaders to continue to reinforce these attitudes among their voters, mm-hmm. you know, in the absence of, you know, what we could quaintly call, you know, a surplus of empirical evidence.
Yeah, and furthermore, in a context in which they've won every election in the last two decades, they've controlled the machinery of state government, and as I mean, you know, I've said to you, some people pointed out to the extent that there are these sort of, you know, new flames about the possibility of undocumented immigrants voting, you know, a friend of mine, you know, said, hey, wasn't voter ID supposed to solve that?
Yeah.
You know, and that's a fair question, right, at this point. But that's not really the conversation we're having, right?
Yeah, not at all.
So let's see. What else should we talk about here? You want to talk about the practical aspects of this?
Yeah,
in some ways?
I mean, yeah. Why don't you talk about that a little bit? You've done some digging in some of this county data, and I think that's interesting. And then we'll come back and kind of end with
some more normative
points.
Yeah, before
maybe.
We get into that. So yeah, you know, there's something that you point out in the piece, kind of near the end, that you brought to light that I think is important to say here, and then we'll kind of, you know, pivot off that, which is, you know, election rules are not normative by nature. They're made by politicians. They have interests in them. You know, there's embedded features to all electoral systems that advantage some groups and disadvantage others.
Right.
You know, sorry, it's just kind of, it is what it is, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, so just from a purely practical standpoint looking at this, you know, if we look at how Republicans have targeted, in particular, you know, the large urban counties, Harris, Bear, and Travis, in a lot of ways, Dallas to a lesser extent, but...
But I think there are explanations for that.
Yeah, there are explanations for that. But if we look just at those four counties, I mean, what you see here is a lot of the rationale for why Republicans are so probably, and I'm just, you know, I'm going to interpret something here, so concerned about voter registration in some of these counties. So if we look at Harris County, for example, in 2012, Mitt Romney only lost Harris County by 971 votes. Right now, I'm using legislative council data, just for those who want to know that. In 2016, 971 votes. That's how close Harris County was. In 2016, Donald Trump lost Harris County by 162,000 votes. In 2020, he lost it by 217,000 votes. If we look at Bear County,
so a trend of increase,
huge increase in the, and this is I'm just looking
and
at
steep,
this is,
a steep trend in the increase right. in. You know, the loss margin in those cities of the Republican presidential candidate.
And this is what we're focused. I mean, I've chosen to kind of focus on here. What is the nature of the Democratic or Republican advantage in each of these counties, right? If we look at Bear County, Mitt Romney lost that county by 23,000 votes in 2012. Trump lost it by 80,000 in 2016 and by 140,000 in 2020. Travis, the most Democratic county, Romney lost by 92,000, double that for Trump in 2016 to 181,000, add another 90,000, he lost it by 274,000 in 2020. In Dallas County, Romney lost by 110,000 in 2012, Trump lost by 198,000 in 2016, and by 291,000 in 2020. And if we look at Tarrant County, where a lot of these activities, you know, some of the most recent, you know, uptick in attention has been, Romney won that county by almost 100,000 votes in 2012, and the county narrowly went Democratic in the next two presidential elections. So overall, if you combine just setting Tarrant County aside, but the biggest four counties here in terms of Harris, but not the biggest, but the big Democratic counties and always in Harris, Bear, Travis, and Dallas, this makes up about 35% of the statewide vote. It went from a 226,000 vote Democratic advantage in 2012 to almost a million vote advantage by 2020. So it increased by almost four times. So there is just a straight you know, if you're sitting here,
a straight political rationale.
Yeah, and if you're just looking at this and saying, okay, you know, the vote, the Democratic advantage in these big counties has, you know, almost doubled or tripled or quadrupled in some cases over the last, you know, three elections. There is an aspect to this to say, you know, and I would throw myself in this camp. What's going to happen in 2024? I don't know.
Right. So just to draw the picture as clearly as possible. So, you know, if you are a Republican statewide official and you see efforts to increase registration going on in those counties, it is in your political interest if you can, you know, to give people the benefit of the doubt to somebody to find legal means of blunting efforts to increase voter registration among a body of voters that you know is increasingly voting against you, you know, we shouldn't be surprised that people are doing that. Now, you know, in the piece, and I think that data really illustrates that really nicely. Now, you know, in the piece, you know, where we kind of wind up is we kind of, to some degree, we want to wind up today, I think, which is, you know, to think about the implications of this dynamic over time. And by this dynamic, I mean, you know, thinking about the longer term cumulative implications of the basic insight that we've used in here a million times, that if you're an academic listening to this, you've probably used a million times this idea that, you know, where you sit back and go, well, you know, election rules, they're inherently political.
Right.
There's going to be politics. Let's not get our hair on fire about it. Or, you know, let's not be clouded by, you know, some kind of, you know, pearl clutching over the fact that people are trying to, you know, adjust the election rules or address the administration of elections.
Impact the composition of the electorate.
It's what happens. But that said, you know, there is, like I said, there is a cumulative effect over time that, you know, the public opinion data points to, and that is, you know, there is, you know, a clear, you know, pattern in which this skepticism of the legitimacy of elections and of the process, both nationally and in the state, has kind of settled into a, you know, it's almost, you know, I would even say stagnated. You know, that's one way of thinking about the dynamic you were explaining so well or you're describing so well earlier. That is, you know, it's a funny thing. Republican lawmakers and the leadership in the state continue to ratchet down, you know, election laws to, you know, to make it the process more stringent, I would say. And yet public opinion doesn't really go, oh, okay, great, you guys have addressed that. There's a demand for more. And that demand for more, you know, which we can talk about in a minute, you know, has been refueled by bringing the issues of immigration, border security, frankly, cultural identity into the mix.
Right.
We'll talk about that in a second and, you know, to kind of close out. But, I mean, I think we want to – I really want to make the point that if we look at that in the longer term – I think it's easy for us and for people that watch public opinion. It's one of those things you go, yeah, you know, there it is. I mean, why would you expect it to change?
Right.
Right. And that's great. But there are side effects of the settling of those attitudes that lead me to use the word stagnant.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, I mean, you and I have talked about this a bit. I mean, you know, you can overthink this and get too wrapped up in the immediate context. And I think forget to step back and say, you know, not so long ago, there were boundaries to how we talked about voter participation and the effort to get people to participate more and even more concretely, you know, the idea of doing voter registration drives and encouraging people to register to vote. That was seen as a public service,
right?
You know, to put it very directly. And that was all buttressed by a norm that said, whatever this other dynamic that we've talked about over here, this, you know, yes, we're going to have political fights over elections and voting. Mm-hmm. Let's all be adults about it. But the nature of that fight has – and the settling of these attitudes is both evidence of and a driver of, you know, what seems to me to be a real decay in the norms around voting. I mean, I think if you had said to somebody 20 years ago, you know, the attorney general is going to be out telling – you know, counties and cities not to make a big effort to register voters, and they're going to, you know, be
enjoying,
you know, really
kind of enjoying them,
enjoying them, and really, you know, really leaning on them both rhetorically and legally. One, if not, you know, you're a little paranoid.
Yeah.
And yet that's where we are. And I think, I don't think there's any way you can't see that as evidence of an ongoing shift in these norms and worry about where we're going.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at the sum total of this and say, so what's, if someone were to say, well, what's the boilerplate, what's going on? And you'd say, yeah, Republican elected officials are using state police powers to try to limit what are generally considered normal campaign activities. And really the normal activities of, election officials in the counties who the state have, charged with running elections to basically make the process easy.
And I think we really want to underline that, the and there, right?
Right.
Because there's, the partis, the nature of, basically rolling out this investigation, that's still sort of foggily defined in legal terms, in terms of what's going on in Bexar County and in that district. It's not just Bexar County, but, the political part, but then also the change in, again, what have been seen as civic functions.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of a real infection of what we, had been previously kind of defined as a civic sphere. And I'm not naive or, I don't want to rewrite history. I'm sure there have been times when there's been subtling maneuvering where, and on both sides, frankly, more often because on the Republican side, because of the demographics and the patterns you talked about, in which people might have subtly said, well, yeah, we should do a voter registration drive, but, we're not going to go out of our way.
Right.
If you're somebody that thinks that's to your disadvantage.
Yeah.
And look, this has happened in almost certainly in areas of in Democratic strongholds in some parts of the state. So I don't want to,
Yeah. And this is also not to say that there aren't, instances in which a voter votes who shouldn't vote. I mean, just to throw this out there or might not be eligible in some way.
Right.
The issue here is the fact of, do we design a system around the possibility that one person might vote illegally if that system means that it's significantly harder for the vast, vast majority of eligible voters to cast a ballot? Or are we even going to discourage people who would be eligible voters from even registering in the process?
Right. And that's, and the change in the normative thinking about that, I think, is really an important piece of all this that, it's easy to be a little, again, too pearl clutchy in the way that you deliver this message. But I think in terms of thinking about, the civic, to use a hokey term, but the civic culture in the state and the way the political system works, this shift, I think, is very significant. And I think we really do, I think it's fair and we should have a conversation about what the implications of that are for the state and for the residents here.
Well, and maybe I am being too pearl clutchy, but I mean, there's the only thing I take issue with in what you said was, the use of the term stagnate. And I'm only just thinking about it in the sense that, stagnate like a swamp maybe, but the issue here, and what's interesting is, we tend to be, again, I think, not to speak for you, but I think, we tend to look at the role that elites play in the formation of public opinion and see it as being a pretty, prime driver, right?
Yeah.
But I also think that, recently, and, this is probably a bigger discussion for a different day, but, I think there have been instances on both sides where you look at the public opinion and then you look at the actions of elected officials, and it's pretty easy to sort of make the case that we're seeing some in the opposite direction here and there. And I think about, Biden's move on the border a while ago and some of his movements there, we saw in public opinion, the Democrats were expressing more concerns about the border. My assumption, and we'd said it at the time on the podcast, was that, Biden saw that data about 2 weeks earlier of his own polling and they change actions. In the case like this, I understand that, Trump is out there, sowing distrust in the election system, but that's not new. I mean, that's not like something that big change. But we have seen this change in the last couple of weeks, again, from a Republican elected official in terms of what they're choosing to talk about. To your point, you didn't say this, but this, the clearly coordinated efforts to some extent.
Yeah. Allowing for within the Republican, food fight going on, factional fighting,
right.
Who's coordinating with who.
Yeah. But I mean, but both, I'd say this coordinated effort to both, on the one hand, tamp down registration efforts in really large urban areas. But on the other hand, so this continue to push this idea of non-citizen voting is this big threat. Now, I do think that that's coming in some ways. I think that's actually coming from the bottom up, which is why I worry that the word stagnate actually is a little bit too generous here because of the fact that there is no endpoint. Like, we're not seeing, again, there's no Republicans going down in Texas saying, hey, guys, we did it.
Yeah, and all I meant by stagnate was, looking at in terms of where a lack of movement induces rot and decay, that, you know, the lack, you know, the steadiness in public opinion.
Yeah, you're
not that the dynamic itself isn't saying.
That's right.
But that's what I meant by stagnant.
Yeah, no, that's perfect. So, you're right. The stagnancy in the sense of the relationship between the voters and elected officials when it comes to this issue leads to continually more efforts to address the issue, but those efforts actually just reinforce the attitudes.
Right.
Now,
rather than, you know, resolve concerns.
And I think the thing is, speaking of resolving concerns and stagnancy, this is where I think the most recent move is actually so damaging, right? So what we've seen, again, historically here is first this focus on fraud. Absent any evidence of fraud, it became this idea to focus on election integrity because you can't ever maximize integrity. So we see continual efforts to maximize integrity. And now we've moved back into this sort of fraud space a bit. But here we're not talking about, you know, I don't even know, dead people voting. The issue here is this idea of non-citizens voting.
Right.
And it's relying on like a specious claim. And it's a claim that's already been, you know, adjudicated and thrown out by the courts in Texas recently, which is to say, what's being done here is to say, well, if we haven't confirmed that somebody on the voter rolls is a citizen affirmatively, we are going to not assume that they're a non-citizen, because if you look at the language that's being thrown out, they're very careful about this, because there's a lot of legal problems here, but we're going to call into question their eligibility to vote. Now, in some corners, that's being pushed further to say there are non-citizens on the voting roll. And for a lot of people, that's the quick jump, is to say, look at this, right?
Right.
Now, setting aside how small these numbers are, the fact that, again, if you go back to the, you know, a former Secretary of State's efforts to purge the voter rolls of these exact same types of issues, and again, I suggest you look it up or go listen to one of our podcasts. Yeah. Like, this is something that's been adjudicated by the courts as, one, not a way to identify non-citizen voters because it's discriminatory. Two, it's very, very highly flawed because of the nature of the data that's being used to sort of reach this conclusion. And then if you do follow through on it, again, you are discriminating in who you're essentially targeting. So, like, just like a lot of these things, I mean, most of Ken Paxton's efforts at the county so far have been stopped by judges. I imagine that, you know, to the extent that this is floating around out there, you notice they're not actually removing people from the rolls. They're not sending letters to people saying, hey, we need to check your citizenship.
Well, they are doing
that. But what they're actually doing is saying, I mean, to your point, is kind of, we're putting on Twitter a letter that we're asking someone else to help us out.
Yeah. And the federal, you know, and look, the politics are good. The federal government,
and the Biden administration,
you know, and there, and again, there is, in the Paxton draft of the letter, there is language, you know, that I think didn't make it into the final draft.
Right. But what you're doing is you're taking this hot, hot issue that's sort of, you know, unresolvable with no real effort to resolve it. And now you're mixing it into what everybody who listens to this know is the issue
without, the hot button issue. The hot button issue. Voters.
Yeah. Immigration, yeah. Border security. And you're saying, no, this is not just a matter of, you know, Democrats, you know, again, deceased people, people out of state, people voting twice. No, this is about non-citizens diluting your vote. And that just hits too many buttons. And so that's why, again, you know, not stagnancy, but like there's, you know, the possibility is this could get worse.
Yeah. I mean
the
look,
way this is going,
you know, this is, I think, where the,
from a normative,
you know, the practical politics on the ground, you know, in, and the patterns in public opinion, you know, meet this institutional, meet the communicative piece that we've been talking about. And you are seeing, you know, a kind of, you know, innovation and modification of the rhetoric among Republican leaders. I mean, I think, and that's why in the case of the Secretary of State's letter to the feds, whatever happens on, you know, with that, the underlying implication is conveyed.
Yeah.
And you've associated the two issues in a way that reinforce that, you know, you could put it, you know, in a more positive way or in the more, you know, stagnant figure of speech way, in both work, which is, you know, this just further reinforces and those attitudes among Republican voters and keeps those levels of concern in place. And in that sense, you know, they're, you know, what I, you know, you could say public attitudes are stagnant in the face of the changes that have been implemented in terms of voting in elections, but, you know, they're still being fed by this rhetoric that associates these voting rules in the absence of actual evidence with the threat out there of, you know, quote unquote, illegals voting on, you know, so.
You know, one final thought for me on this is, you know, I do wonder about the overall, you know, effectiveness. I mean, in the long term, I think there's a real danger, you know, but I don't expect the elected officials to think beyond a given election. So I'll set that aside. But I do wonder, you know, it's notable to me that most of the people in Texas who are pushing this are not on the ballot.
This time.
Yeah. Right. During this recent moment are not on the ballot. And I do wonder to what extent, you know, I mean, I get, you know, we're doing a lot of events right now. And, you know, I get the question kind of regularly about, you know, do I have concerns about, you know, whether polling impacts people's likelihood to turn out or something. And that's a topic for another day. The answer is no. But, you know, I do think, you know, people pointed this out in 2020 in particular, you know, does saying that the system is rigged and really trumpeting that message towards Republican voters help or hurt turnout? I mean, just saying, you know, that the system is flawed, that undocumented immigrants are voting, that the process is rigged. I mean, is that really a winning message in a close election? You know, and I think, you know, where turnout is just so important for both parties, you know, I do wonder whether there's really a net benefit, at least on the mobilization side in the most immediate term, to continue to fan these flames of illegitimacy about the process you're asking people to participate in.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that's come up in a very direct, mechanical way in Republicans in swing states' response to, you know, one of the Trump speech set pieces about the evils of mail-in voting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In which, you know, Republicans that are in charge, that are trying to mobilize voters, many of their voters who have traditionally until, you know, pre-Trump, liked mail-in voting, or, you know, absentee voting with excuse, et cetera.
Right.
So, no, I think that's a good point. I think we'll end around here. I urge you to find the piece on the blog section at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. And if you're listening to this podcast on a platform, we'll post that piece along with this podcast and, you know, a little taste of some other illustrating data that we've referred to. So, with that, thanks to Josh for joining and all the prep work on the podcast, as always. Also, thanks to our excellent production team in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin. Couldn't do it without you guys. For more content, all our polling results, please go to texaspolitics.utexas.edu. While there, you'll find all kinds of other bonuses, including our much-trafficked internship bulletin board. If you are a participant in Texas politics, or you're somebody looking for internships for you or some young people you know, that is the most trafficked source of internships and opportunities in the state. And it's just follow the link to internships on our website. And of course, most of all, thanks to you for listening. And we'll be back soon with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.